Straight from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hello, Darren Patterson. How are you doing, Darren Patterson? I'm talking to you, Darren Patterson.
I'm doing well, John Trumbull. How are you, John Trumbull? John Trumbull, did you catch a fever, the Knicks fever? Let's go Knicks. Are you all psyched and pumped up?
Oh, how well you know me.
Yeah, I know, I thought like something like this. I mean, look, I know you're not a sports guy. I'm not a sports guy. But, I mean, we're both in the tri-state area. And the fact that the New York Knicks, that have been a terrible, terrible basketball team for so long, are now able to sort of get themselves out of the muck and mire and are like now in the finals and are inches, a few games away from winning it all. I feel like that would excite everybody in the tri-state area, no matter whether you follow the game or no. It's just like exciting for a East Coaster. Am I wrong in that assumption?
I mean, I have absolutely nothing against it. I've seen some chatter about it online, but I don't have like terrestrial TV anymore, so I'm not. If I don't seek it out, it doesn't really exist.
I don't watch TV. La la la.
No, I mean it's not.
You know, I read.
No, it's not. It's not like a hipster thing. It was more of like a budgetary thing.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're just poor. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Got it. And I don't really care to follow most sports. So I've like muted words like football, baseball, and basketball on stuff like Blue Sky. So it's very easy for me to avoid this stuff.
Okay. So lacrosse can still get into your algorithm, is what you're saying?
Probably. I guess. Yeah.
Croquet. Or
sure, yeah.
I'm trying to think of all the
snooker,
frisbee golf.
I've probably muted the word golf. I don't know. I'd have to check. You know,
hacky sack. I don't know.
I mute words and hashtags of things that I have no interest in. You know, like most sports, the Cardassians, Lena Dunham.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. You know, keep all that out of your life.
Certain politicians.
I mean, that's just for your mental well-being.
That's it. I'm not either enraged or depressed or infuriated, I'm just not inundated with a lot of stuff I'm not personally interested in.
Okay.
Hey, it's great. It sounds like a cool story from what you've just described to me now. This is the most I've heard about it, honestly. So,
I don't follow basketball. I just kind of know about it through osmosis. And, like, I know that a lot of my friends who are huge, you know, basketball fans who grew up in New York, because, a little fun fact, guys, I'm from New York City. I don't know if I told you guys that.
This has never been revealed on the podcast before.
I don't want to brag, but I grew up in New York. So, you know, I'm pretty cool. I'm pretty fly, pretty funky fresh. And like all my friends, all the time I had growing up, the Knicks have always kind of sucked and always were close to getting it all and never got it. Like, I think I still remember in 99 they made it to the finals and then they lost it, and then ever since then they've just been kind of just a horrible team until now. And like, now everybody, all my friends are like, this is it, this is our moment, and all the New Yorkers are, you know, up in arms and cheering, and it's like, oh, this is it's a beautiful moment to be a New Yorker. It's like a nice little ray of sunshine in this crumulent year that we're living in.
Yeah, I mean, that is very cool. I love it when, yeah, there is something like that that a whole bunch of people can come together on and be like, oh yes, this is the thing that we're all behind. And it's, you know, we don't have as many of those mass bonding experiences as we used to.
Yeah, I mean, there's one that'll probably come up in years to come when certain someone passes away, but I that's all I'll say about that, because I don't want the FBI knocking on my door. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Yeah, that'll be something.
Oh, what a day that will be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be like VJ day.
You know? Yeah, I'm already buying party favors. I got fireworks, streamers, the whole kit and caboodle.
That day, that's, wow. Yeah, no work is going to get done that day.
No, not at all. Not at all. My God. Oh, forget about it. But, you know, enough of us talking about a certain someone's demise. Let's talk about this documentary. The documentary Lorne that was just released on Peacock. We're also recording this a day after the Tonys, where the subject of this documentary, Mr. Lorne Lipowitz, won a Tony for Schmigadoon.
Oh, yes. I think I did. I did read that Schmigadoon won at the Tonys, and I'd forgotten that Lorne was a producer on the show. That's very cool. Okay.
Very cool. Very cool. So, yeah, we're talking about the documentary Lorne, directed by Morgan Neville, the man who directed Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers doc, the Steve Martin doc that's on Apple, and Man on the Run, which is the Paul McCartney doc that documents Paul's life after the Beatles with Wings and whatnot.
Yeah, I just recently watched the Man on the Run doc, and I was very impressed with that. And I was like, I've got to watch more of this guy's work because he's really good. He's really good.
Yeah, he's very good. I mean, I've only seen parts of the Steve Martin doc just because it's kind of a lot. He does it in two parts. Mm-hmm. He does it like, you know, Steve Martin's kind of early days of comedy and SNL and the stand-up and the jerk era. But then there's that whole sort of second era of Steve, like in the 80s when he was like more serious and like not as, you know, goofy. And it was like L.A. Story and like, you know, Grand Canyon type of...
those were the early 90s, my friend.
Early 90s. I don't know time, John.
How dare you? How dare you?
But, you know, like when he got a little bit more... He wasn't as slapstick and he got a little bit more grounded and serious, started collecting art and whatnot. Yeah. You know, the thinking man's Steve
Martin. But I'm looking at Morgan Neville's filmography on Letterboxd right now. And he also did that documentary about backup singers, 20 Feet from Stardom.
Oh, yes.
He did a documentary about Orson Welles, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. Mm. He did a documentary called Roadrunner about Anthony Bourdain. Okay. So he picks really interesting subjects. He has quite the pedigree. I'm going to have to watch more of this guy's stuff.
Okay. So, I mean, now that knowing what you know about him now, like, what do you think about what he did with this documentary, the Lorne doc?
Well, I mean, if we're just going to bottom line it right at the top, I love this. I thought it was terrific. I gave it like 5 stars on my Letterboxd profile, a Trumbull comic. Follow me there. This was terrifically done. We've seen other behind the scenes docs on SNL where they're like following you through a week or something, but I think this is the best one of its kind that I've seen. And it seems like he had more access than most any other SNL doc I've seen. I mean, you know, we're seeing things like we're in the meeting with Lorne when they're deciding on the sketches, and we see like Lorne giving a pep talk between dress and air. And I mean, yeah, it's really incredible. And Lorne Michaels seems to be, I guess you could say, a reticent subject.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, he's very, he's notoriously elusive.
Yeah.
And he just kind of doesn't like to really stay in the spotlight or even talk about himself. Like, even at the very beginning of this, like, they interview people like Paul Simon and Tom Schiller. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, yeah, this maybe wasn't a good idea to have this doc about Lorne because, like, he won't give you much. And
yeah. Steve Higgins actually says, like, oh, I feel bad for you. You're doing this documentary on Lorne. And there's lots of footage of Lorne Michaels just like, oh, right, the cameras are recording me. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. You know?
And it's not like he's like, oh, no, I've got to be on my best behavior. It's just more of a general, like, I don't want to be a subject of a documentary.
Yeah, I think there's at one point he walks into his office, he sees the camera, and he says, Jesus, this is why I don't want this. This is why I don't want this.
Yeah. and like, as an introvert, I get that. That speaks to me.
Yeah, it's like, oh.
No. This doc, it's also narrated by Chris Parnell, and I think Chris Parnell did a wonderful job. He's got like just a very soothing voice, and it's just it gives you a very relaxing vibe for the
Yeah, doc. No, I mean, there's a reason why he gets so much voiceover work. Like his voice is just as smooth as eggs.
Yeah.
That's like a fine glass of brandy.
Like butter.
Like butter. Marron. It's beautiful. But yeah, I mean, I did think the way this doc was structured was interesting. Because, yeah, it does go into the week leading up to the show, which we've seen in previous documentaries before. But it also interweaves kind of like interviews with other people about Lorne and a little bit about Lorne's past and his upbringing. You know, Talking Heads, like John Mulaney.
Lots of cast members, like they're like, what do I know about his childhood? Well, he's from Toronto or a suburb of Toronto, I think. And, you know, it's just like they obviously haven't had this discussion with Lorne very much.
Yeah. I think John Mulaney says, oh, I quickly ascertained that he's fucking with you a lot.
Yeah.
When you talk with him.
Yeah.
And they also did another thing that I kind of liked where they animated some of Lorne's interactions like TV Funhouse style.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the old Smigel.
Robert Smigel, J.J. Sotomayor.
Yeah.
TV Funhouse segments. That was a clever way to do it. Because like so many documentaries, they're terrified of just being like a series of talking heads. So they're always looking for ways to like juice it up. And,
yeah.
And this was a good way to do it, but it wasn't too obtrusive. And it fit the topic, I think.
I think so. I think so. You know, they go back to when Lorne first got to New York in 75 and, you know, how he was looking to have a show to take up the old Carson slot. And, you know, they mentioned things like, of course, the Bee Hospital, which they interview Rosie Schuster, like them, her saying, like, yeah, this was never going to work on TV. But he saw the Absurdist best potential. The network told him to drop the Bees. So as a, you know, just to stick it to them, they just brought back the Bees more and more, just like straight up out of spite.
Yeah, like, so you're seeing them on the second episode with Paul Simon. They're on the third show with Rob Reiner and Penny Marshall. Mm. And then after that, they said the network asked for more Bees. Which just shows how mercurial network notes are.
Yep, the network doesn't know what it's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess they just thought, oh, they're on the show three times in a row. They must be popular. Or it turned the audience around on it. I don't know. That's such a funny story. And it was interesting to see, like, we were seeing clips of the early years of the show, but they're not the clips that we've seen a million times on anniversary shows and things like that. They found some stuff that's, like, a little more obscure, a little more off the beaten path, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, then they talk more about how no one really seems to know what Lorne does after the show. Like, like I think Streeter and Mikey said, like, oh, he just has dinner with a lot of cool people. Alec, they talked to Alec Baldwin, who says he's done yoga with Lorne.
Yeah, like at one point Tina Fey is like, well, I don't know Lorne as well as like Alec Baldwin. I've never stood in the ocean with Lorne.
Yeah.
And Paul Simon, at one point, he confesses that he basically made up a fake bio of Lorne Michaels for Vanity Fair. And then that ended up getting quoted in Lorne's Wikipedia entry. Like, you know, he was born in a shibbutz.
A kibbutz in the British Mandate of Palestine.
Yeah. And I guess in Paul Simon's mind, he thought, this is so absurd, no one will ever believe it. But, like, lots of people believed it, because I guess Lorne is such a mysterious figure. And even though, like, we both read that biography of Lorne that came out last year that Susan Morrison wrote, and she guested on the podcast about it.
Yeah, and she's in this documentary, too.
Yeah, and she does pop up in this documentary. He still is this very mysterious figure, because he doesn't give a whole lot of interviews, you know?
Yeah. Like at one point in the doc, they talk about his wife and three kids.
Yes.
Which first of all, I didn't know he had three kids. I knew he had I knew he had kids. I didn't know he had three kids. And secondly, the doc like blurs out their faces. They put like a big orange sticker on it. So you have no idea.
They got yellow circles over all their faces. What a cute, humorous way to do it.
Yeah. Like they're in witness relocation or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wild.
You know, they talk about how he does have somewhat of a regular schedule. He like will go to bed at 4 a.m, gets up at noon. And this is a man who is now 80. That's pretty exceptional.
Yeah.
They say he eats at the same restaurants. He orders the same food. And someone was theorizing like, I think his week is so chaotic and up in the air, he likes that certain amount of routine in his week.
Mm.
And I forget who exactly was saying that, but...
But, yeah.
It does make sense.
Yeah, like, he has an aquarium in his office. I think they talked to the guy who's been tending to that aquarium for, like, 40 years.
Yeah.
And he just likes his fish and his popcorn machine.
Yeah.
In there, and he just
By the way, he really needs to clean that popcorn machine.
It looked pretty grody. I didn't want to say anything. Like,
there's so much congealed grease on that thing. I used to work in a movie theater, so I remember cleaning the popcorn machine. And I was like, oh, that really needs to be cleaned.
It's like, Lauren, you make all the money in the world. Clean your goddamn popcorn machine. Disgusting.
Yeah, but we see, like, you know, the Monday meeting where they're, like, brainstorming possible sketch ideas. And an interesting thing the doc does is that they don't just pick one week to follow through. Morgan Neville was obviously following Lorne around for the better part of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So we see lots of guest hosts. We see, like, Kate McKinnon in there.
Yay.
She's in there as a host, and they say it's, like, the last show of 2023. We see Timothy Chalamet, son of a bitch.
Chalamet. Shane Gillis, we see
Shane Gillis, like, picking sketches he liked, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I like Limu Emu."
Ayo Edebiri, we see, yeah. Like, they all went to dinner at one of Lauren's restaurants.
Right.
Once he goes to them and the cast, whatever. So that.
And like, you know, sometimes it's like Lauren is, like, giving a speech to somebody, and then they'll cut to, like, different hosts, and it's like, oh well, these obviously aren't from the same week, but somehow it all works, and it's not too disjointed. So I was pretty impressed with that.
Yeah. I did like the scene where, you know, when everybody pitches ideas on that Monday.
Yeah.
And they showed the one with Kate. And Michael Longfellow pitched a joke so funny that Kate, like, laughed her ass off and hugged him. I was like, damn it, Longfellow. I wish you were there.
I know. Yeah, we do get to see, because this was shot in, like, 2023, 2024. We see a few cast members who aren't on the show anymore, like Michael Longfellow. Molly Carney was in there.
I think I saw Trost a little bit.
I miss Trost, but
I think I think she pops up in a few scenes.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah. And, you know, we see all the Please Don't Destroy boys, and and the, like, Marcello pitched a joke at the Monday meeting at one point. He was talking about, like, I think getting a call from his aunt or his grandmother, and was like, what's the difference between a butt dial and a booty call? Which is so damn funny.
It's pretty funny. See, Marcello's funny.
Yeah. I was just like, oh, that's, I really like that. That's a solid joke.
There we go. There we go, Marcello. All right.
And we kind of trace through Lauren's history of the show. And he talks about, you know, like, the early years of 75 to 80. And then he talks about, like, leaving the show along with, like the rest of the cast in 1980, like, you know, Chevy Chase left early on, infamously, and then Aykroyd and Belushi left before the fifth year.
That really broke his heart.
Yeah, and then everybody left at the end of the fifth year, and Lorne just says, present day Lorne says, like, for the show to be reinvented, it had to be blown up.
Right.
And then, you know, and then he leaves the show for 5 years. That wasn't, like, his intended period of time away. That's just what it turned out to be. But
yeah, no, because I think Susan Morrison, who pops up, says that Lauren thought he could just take a bit of a break after 5 years, clean house, hire new people, start fresh, but it didn't occur to him that the show wasn't his intellectual property.
Right.
And I was like, oh wow, yeah, I guess.
And they're talking about, at one point, they briefly cover the new show, which was the show that Lorne did, lasted all of 9 episodes. And we actually see, like, a few clips of that and a few behind the scenes clips of that. And Buck Henry is saying to Lorne, he's like, oh, well, at least you still have a piece of SNL. And Lorne's like, no, I don't. I walked away from that. I don't have any ownership of SNL. And Buck Henry was like, what? You fucking idiot.
You walked away. Yeah, I think Lauren says, yeah, you know, it's just a Canadian me. Just be nice.
Because, you know, I and Buck Henry, I mean, this is a man who, among other things, he co-created the series Get Smart. So he probably knows something about creating a successful TV show and residuals and all that. And I hope at some point in the years since that Lauren has negotiated some sort of ownership of SNL. I would hope so.
I would hope so. I mean, he must. He's got to, right?
He's got to, but I mean, yeah, but who knows?
Maybe, you know, saving his money to get that popcorn machine cleaned.
Something I was impressed by was they made the point that he has had the same office at 30 Rock since 1975. He's never moved into a bigger office. And you see his office in this doc, and it is smaller than you would expect.
Yeah, I was expecting something more like a whole floor dedicated to him.
Yeah, like some lavish executive thing. But no, it's still like this mid-size office that he got in the mid-70s. And I guess he's just... And obviously he wasn't occupying it for those 5 years he was away from the show, but I guess he was able to get it back.
Yeah.
Dick Ebersol or whoever was using it.
Yeah. I mean, the doc does say he's a creature of habit. So,
yeah
maybe he would just feel weird being at a bigger office. He's like, you know, no, this works for me.
Yeah. I wonder if that was like a negotiation point. He was like, well, I have to have the same office.
Non-negotiable. Same office. And don't clean the popcorn machine. The grease and butter, it helps the popcorn flavor.
Yeah. And let's see. Yeah, they talk to the maitre d' at one of the three restaurants he's a regular at, Latanzi, an Italian restaurant. And the maitre d', very tight lipped. He's kind of like, you know how they say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. That's how it is with Lauren and the cast dinners. and we see a little footage of them eating with Io Edebiri. And like Chloe Fineman is talking about, she's like, oh yeah, you're like panic eating Branzino. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah. And also on Tuesday, they also show it's writing night and how everybody is, you know, back at the office is kind of punching away at a script and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Susan, this is where they have Susan Morrison again saying things like, why is it done this way? Why do you have to write all night? Why can't we reuse sketches that get killed? Why can't we write sketches in the downtime? And then Lauren says that the fatigue is your friend.
Yeah, he basically is like, yeah, you're going to come up with weirder creative ideas if you're staying up all night and you're writing this at like 3 or 4 in the morning. And I do see the logic in that. Yeah, I have certainly come up with like some of my favorite comedic ideas, or even just creative ideas in general, in the middle of the night when I can't quite get to sleep, or sometimes in the morning when I'm like just starting to wake up. Mm-hmm. Like there's something, your mind is like very unfettered at that time of the day. So I see the logic of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he says like through exhaustion and just being straight up depleted, the mm-hmm. subconscious takes over and you take way bigger risks than you normally would. Which
you kind of remove that filter in your brain, which is like, you don't overthink this stuff, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, but also I feel like some of the weirdest war sketches we've seen have been because of that too. But
that's the downside of it. But but the great thing is you will get bizarre stuff you never would have thought of otherwise.
Yeah, sometimes you get amazing stuff. Other times you get like the Bird Family or something mm-hmm. like that. Which I still have a hard time watching that sketch. Yikes.
Oh, where they're regurgitating the food into
you. Yeah, it's like, yeah.
I mean, that's very intentionally cringe comedy, yeah.
Yeah.
We see a brief shot of, like, Dismukes and James Austin Johnson's shared office, which, again, smaller than you would expect. It looks like barely over a closet.
Yeah, like, I know the writers, the offices that, like, that they share, like, they're always pretty small. Like, it's barely like a college dorm.
Yeah, you got to like get to know somebody really well when you're sharing an office that size with them.
Oh, intimate.
And hope to God you get along. But I was like, I would love to just be a fly on the wall in those two offices, because they have come up with some of my favorite bizarre sketches. Mm. And even though I haven't loved every single one of them, I do admire them taking the big swings. Same with like Mikey Day and Streeter Seidel, which I think they share an office. If I remember correctly.
I believe so, yeah.
Because they write together a lot, so.
Yeah. I think in this doc, they were going over that those jingle pitch guys mm-hmm. that they did for the Jenna Ortega episode, where they just, like, scream out the phone number
And oh, yeah.
I think that's what they were doing. And then Chloe was like knocking on the door, was like, hey, can you guys keep it down a little?
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm just kidding. I'm just joshing.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the doc kind of touches on Lorne a little bit, going to write on Laughing in the 60s.
Yeah, we see long-haired, mustachioed Lorne Michaels, a.k.a. Porn Michaels.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I cannot get enough of footage of late 60s, early 70s Lorne Michaels, where he has this mustache and, like, this long hair, because he just looks so different from the conservative guy he looks like now.
Yeah. When I grow up, I want to have Lorne Michaels' mustache.
Yeah. And he talks about how when he was writing on Laughing, like, there wasn't really any interaction between the writers and the cast. He wouldn't go to tapings. So he wasn't, he felt very disconnected from the show. It wouldn't be until he watched the show that he would even know if any of his jokes made it in, because he would be rewritten a lot.
Yeah, it says the writers were in, like, a separate building entirely from where the...
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's just like... I mean, that is one of the benefits of SNL, I think, is there is so much interaction between the writers and the cast, and there's hardly any separation there, I think.
Yeah, no, the show's very writer-forward, which I always appreciated. Mm-hmm. And he was here with his writing partner, Hartz Pomerantz.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And let's see, we also see the table read, which I think that happens on Wednesday. And we've narrowed the sketches down from like 60 to around 40. And they were talking about how they never bail on a sketch at the read-through, even if it sucks.
Ooh.
They read through the whole damn thing. It's never like we get to page 400 and it's like, okay, well, I think we can see this isn't working.
we're all done with this, right?
And we're seeing, at one point we see like sort of a round table with John Mulaney, Bill Hader, Fred Armisen, and... Was it Andy Samberg?
Yes, it was Samberg.
Yeah. So the four of them, and they're talking about that. And I think it was John Mulaney says, like, oh, whenever, like, a waiter comes by and brings Lorne a script, Lorne just graciously accepts it because apparently Charles Manson, one of the people Charles Manson targeted was somebody who turned down his demos.
Yeah. It was a really good story. Like, I do like when John Mulaney tells stories.
Yeah,
I wish he'd do more of it because he is a good storyteller.
I mean, he's an excellent storyteller, and he and like Bill Hader, they're obviously just such students of Hollywood history and pop culture history in general. And yeah, they live for that stuff, and I think to a degree, Fred Armisen and Samberg too, but those two in particular.
Yeah,
and then like, oh wow.
Yeah, and then like I think Mulaney goes on to say like how in the '70s they were doing some Charles Manson sketches. And
right.
At one point, they got a letter from Squeaky Frome saying, yeah. And the letter said, like,
you've been a naughty boy.
Yeah. And he said, Charlie is God. Charlie is Jesus. Smiley face. And
yeah.
He said, for Lorne, the smiley face is what really freaked him out.
Yeah. And I was just like, I mean, that honestly sounds like a good policy. It's just like politely accept it. And then you think your script will be considered. But
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you never. Hey, I mean, Hitler got rejected from art school, and
yeah,
look where that got us.
And you know, you never know what the makeup of somebody is who's like reaching out to you and submitting something. So.
Yeah, so you know, you don't want that one person to be like, "Oh, he rejected my work. I'll make them all pay."
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I think even if they think they are being considered, that probably goes a long way.
Yes.
to calming the potential.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So after the table read, they've narrowed it from like 60 written sketches down to like 40. And then they select 10 to 12 sketches to actually produce for dress and air.
Yeah. So much work goes into these things.
I mean, and the attrition rate too is incredible. Like they are writing 60 sketches a week and only a sixth of those get produced. That's unreal.
Yeah, and then once those get produced, then they got to build a set, and then they got to do costumes,
yeah.
Then they got to do rehearsals and all this shit.
And they're putting this together, realistically, in the space of about 5 days. So
wild.
Yeah, it really is wild when you just think about the sheer logistics of it. And it's not until you watch docs like this, you're like, oh god, just even to produce a disappointing show is still a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of work went into this turn of a show, but I appreciate it.
Chris Rock is also, he was talking about Lorne's comedy career before he got to SNL, like, because he was also a performer, like a sort of a, I guess, is it fair to say nightclub comedian?
Who, Chris? Yeah, he's a comic.
No, not Chris Rock is obviously a comic. I'm talking about Lorne Michaels.
Oh, okay. He was
working with his partner, Pomeranz.
No, I don't think he was a stand-up. I think he was like a performer. They had the, they moved back to Canada in 1970, and then they had the Hart and Lorne Terrific Hour.
Right.
Where we once again see Lorne's magnificent mustache. Mm-hmm. But then that got canceled, and then Lorne moved back to L.A. to sort of reinvent himself as a producer.
But like Chris Rock, he had a quote, which I thought was very, again, very insightful. Like Chris Rock will occasionally just hit you with something that's like, oh my God, that is so fucking true. He's such a smart guy. But he said in sports, all the great coaches were middling players.
That was a good quote.
Yeah. And that kind of gives you insight into like, you know, what it takes to be a great coach. It doesn't necessarily follow that you were a great player. And the same kind of applies to being the comedy writer and producer that he is today. And, you know, he didn't have tremendous success as a performer, but he had a bit of success. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I think as it's a thing where like, yeah, you really have this love for entertainment, but mm-hmm. maybe you're not the best performer, but you have other strengths that you kind of explore. And so when he went back to LA to reinvent himself, we find out that Lily Tomlin hired him to write and produce her TV specials.
Right. Right. And they got into this in Susan Morrison's Lorne biography too. But it's a very different experience, like actually seeing this stuff rather than just reading about it.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think, yeah, it's more made for a documentary probably than a book. Not that the book isn't great. Lily Tomlin was essentially Lorne's former boss, and they make the point that like if it wasn't for Lily Tomlin, SNL might never have happened. Because she was the first guy, she was the first person who gave Lorne Michaels a shot at writing and producing a variety show on TV. So,
yeah, no, it's pretty fantastic that she did that. But then it kind of bounces back to 1981, where after Lorne mm-hmm. quit SNL and he talked about how, yeah, he was kind of by himself a lot. It was, you know, mm-hmm. he kind of went through this big breakup.
Yeah.
He said he built a pond, but then somebody do another talking head to correct him. He's like, no, he had a pond built. He did not dig a hole.
Yeah, Lorne is not digging a trench. hiring people and he's telling people how he wants the pond.
I want it here, you know, just nice and welcoming, but not too ostentatious.
Yeah, and you know, he says, Lorne Michaels says, yeah, no one believes me, but no, I didn't watch the show during those 5 years that I wasn't producing it. Because he does liken it to a breakup, and it's like, if you just stop dating your significant other, if you just got divorced, yeah, you're probably not going to want to hear a whole lot about them. So
yeah, you don't want to see your ex with her new dude. Fuck
yeah,
that.
I get that. I get
fuck that.
Fuck
that noise. Yeah,
and he also like at one point in the mid '80s, he takes a trip to Graceland with Paul Simon, which helped inspire the album Graceland by Paul Simon.
An amazing album. What a Paul Simon.
Yeah, that is like the Paul Simon album.
I'd say so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got all bangers. The album rocks.
You know, Paul Simon, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo. Just incredible, incredible album. If you haven't heard Graceland, get off your ass.
Yeah, I know what I know. Forget about it.
That's a great one.
I'm on the dance floor, baby. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, damn. But I was like, I had no idea that Lorne Michaels was on that road trip with Paul Simon. And then at one point, they actually get pulled over. The cop recognizes Paul Simon. And there's a photo that Lorne Michaels took of Paul Simon, like, signing an autograph for the cop on the hood of the cop's car.
Always love a fan.
Just incredible. Incredible. Let's see. So they also get into the new show, which was the show that Lorne produced during that hiatus. Ellen's Wybell has says that show was a fucking nightmare. He is not mincing words.
I don't know how else to put it. That show was a fucking nightmare.
And there were all sorts of budget overruns, and Lorne was like on the line for it.
Yeah, because I mean, the story of the new show is pretty infamous. I think according to what Downey said, he said it looked like SNL, but didn't have any of the live right. energy because it was pre-taped.
Right.
It's not live right. at all. So, like, they had time to, like, stop it and make corrections and then shoot it again. So
and then they're really editing it. And, you know, it sounded like it was just second guess to death, basically.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, part of the beauty of SNL is it is a live show. So you put it out there and it basically is what it is. I mean, they do occasionally substitute dress versions of the sketches for the live taping and reruns. But that initial live airing, that's what the show is, man.
Yeah, and I mean, I've never seen an episode, although I probably could. I'm pretty sure they have some episodes up on YouTube and stuff. But, like,
mm-hmm. it has, the new show?
Of the new show, yeah, like, in yeah. full. But, like, it has, good people. Like, Catherine O'Hara's in it. John Candy's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Goldblum's in a few episodes. Those are all, like, solid folks. But yeah. from what I've, by all accounts, from what I've heard, everybody says, yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
We should maybe check it out on YouTube and maybe do an episode on that. There are only 9 episodes. I don't know if it's like a half hour show or an hour show, but
we'll take a peek. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe
if we have the time.
Yeah.
I think it's Lorne who says this. He says the thing that kills most things is overthinking.
Mm. He says a lot of wise things throughout this doc.
That is so true. Because I can be a big overthinker, and yeah, that nothing can kill your momentum like overthinking.
Yeah, like I have found that if you overthink anything, honestly, you end up maybe either not doing it or doing like a yeah. lesser version of it.
Yeah, it's a compromise, or worse, you're just paralyzed, and you're just like, I can't do this thing.
Right. So.
Yeah.
So just go in not thinking. Just say whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, like
that's what I loved about when I was doing improv was you just kind of remove that filter in your brain between thinking of a thing and doing or saying the thing. You just do it.
Yeah.
Don't and think, that's so refreshing, man.
Don't think twice.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And,
So then we get to Thursday.
Yeah.
Show's beginning to take shape. We see the Emma Stone episode where she hosted.
Mm-hmm.
We see.
Oh, that one.
You know, that one.
That Emma Stone hosted. She was a five-timer club.
I'm not disrespect. I'm just saying, hey, man, hey, whoa. I'm just saying she hosted.
It's the episode that she hosted in this time period.
Yeah, most recently.
Okay. I think it's the one where she was naked on a garbage truck.
Yeah. Oh, yes, right. Okay.
You remember that? That was a pre-taped segment?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. You're right. So, yeah, then they go to Lorne having dinner with Steve Martin. And then they kind of cut back to the times after the new show and that whole debacle and how mm-hmm. Steve Martin back then talked to Lorne about the Three Amigos and, you know, like saying, hey, do you want to write this movie? And Lorne ended up writing it with Randy Newman and Steve Martin.
Yeah. And he talked about how it was a very joyous experience for him because it was just. It was joyfully funny, and it was like this big dumb movie, and it got him to get back to writing, and so it sounds like it was really psychologically helpful for him at the time because it kind of broke him out of his funk, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, the movie, you know, did what it did, and it's still like a beloved kind of cult movie that you know we've talked about.
We watched the Marty Short documentary last week. What did it open behind?
Oh, The Golden Child.
Yeah, it opened second to The Golden Child, which is in itself kind of an infamous flop. So it didn't do so hot, but it's become like this major cult film in the years since. And I think it's certainly better regarded than The Golden Child.
I would say so. Yeah. I don't think I've ever even seen The Golden Child now that I think about it.
Neither have I. So, yeah, maybe we should put that on the list.
Maybe, because I heard it's not like a straightforward comedy like Eddie Murphy's. You know, movies were around that time. It's kind of an action movie, and he kind of plays it straight, but he has some comedic parts here and there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think I've ever seen The Golden Child in full. That I really think about.
Like most Americans, I have not seen The Golden Child. I know The Golden Child mainly for two things. One, that is, I think there's a prop knife that was reused in the movie version of The Shadow.
Ooh.
And two, that's the movie that Eddie Murphy decided to do instead of Star Trek IV.
Wow.
Because in the early days of Star Trek IV, he was going to be like the guy in the 20th century that the crew met when they traveled back in time.
Oh, so he's going to be playing himself.
Well, he's not playing himself. He was playing like a teacher who like kind of helps them on their mission with the
guys
and all that.
Oh, okay. But, all right.
You know, but I think part of the thinking was like the Paramount people were like, oh, well, like Eddie Murphy movies are huge and Star Trek movies are huge. You know, why put all our eggs in one basket? Mm. So that was kind of the thinking. So they were like, why put Eddie Murphy into a Star Trek movie when we can have an Eddie Murphy movie and a Star Trek movie?
You can have it all.
Yeah. And I think Eddie Murphy was ultimately like, yeah, I think I'm going to do Golden Child instead. That seems like the better bet.
That's where the money's at.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So then we cut to 1985, where Lauren gets a call from Brandon Tartikoff at NBC. He wants him to produce SNL. And he basically
come
said,
back to the show.
Come back to, and I think he said, like, if you don't come back, we're probably just going to cancel the show.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah, it was pretty on in a... It was in a bad way, the show, at this point.
Yeah, and I think Lauren, he tells the story early on when he decides to leave SNL, there was some executive, and I'm blanking on the person's name now, who, like, sort of took him aside and tells him, okay, here's what's going to happen. Like, you're going to go away. The show is gradually going to get bad, but it'll take, like, 2 or 3 years for the audience to really catch on to how bad the show is, and then the show's going to be, like, really at a low point. And then, you know, we'll think about canceling it, and then maybe we'll come back to you. And it's like, just beat by beat, this guy apparently called what exactly happened with SNL. Ooh. And just the cycle it went through, which is amazing.
Pretty prophetic.
Yeah, yeah. And so he talks about, like, that 1985-86 season.
The weird year.
The weird year, as it was, that was dubbed in the doc they did last year. And Lauren says, like, sort of the big mistake he made was he hired actors instead of comedians. Mm. And if you look at that cast, it is mostly actors.
Yeah, you got Robert Downey Jr., Joan Cusack.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Michael Hall. Randy Quaid.
Quaid, yeah, just, like, straight-up actors.
Right, yeah, and you got, like, you know, a few Second City people in there, like Nora Dunn, and I forget where Terry Sweeney came from.
Lovitz, of course.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. I'm here.
And this was a really interesting insight, is Lauren says, I didn't fire anybody in those first 5 years. And I'm thinking about it, and I was like, oh, shit, that's right. Yeah, because Chevy Chase left on his own. Belushi and Aykroyd left on their own. And then everybody else left en masse at the end of season 5. So it's like, yeah, he really didn't fire anybody at all in those first 5 years. So he's reaching the end of the 85 season, and he has to decide to let most of the cast go. That's wild.
I think they also mentioned, like, this was, like, the first time he was leaning into, like, kind of wearing a suit and tie to work. Mm-hmm. Like,
he became the boss.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, like you said, like, in the first 5 years, he was just kind of there, almost sort of like contemporary. He'd, like, kind of dressed like the cast and crew, and, you know, just like, yeah, I'm just like you guys. But, like, now that he's older, he has, like, the little salt and pepper hair. He's like, no, I'm the boss now. I have to
just
like
and the boss. It is sort of a generational shift, because it is, like, 10 years after the show started. And then he also talks about how that year, because it wasn't a very successful season, it wasn't very popular, the SNL kind of went back to being an underdog. Because this was, of course, like, you know, while Lauren was away from the show, we had the Eddie Murphy years, and we had that year where it was just, where Dick Ebersol was producing the show, and he just, like, brought in a bunch of ringers, like Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer.
Martin Short was there.
Martin Short, yes, I knew I was forgetting somebody significant.
Yeah.
established comedy stars to come in and basically save the show. And then Lorne Michaels comes back, and it's mostly unknowns again. And it's a weird schizophrenic sort of cast.
Yeah. Because, like, this is where, like, after he let go of all the people from season 11, then that's when we get the Carvey, Hartman, Hooks, Kevin Nealon, our era, basically. Like, you and me, our era, basically.
Like, this is when Darren and I both started watching the show seriously.
Yeah.
I'd seen, I think, the odd episode here and there, but... like in around 86, I'm like 14 or so. Perfect age to get into SNL.
Mm. It's good stuff.
And I think it was Dana Carvey who says, like, the new cast, they were told, yeah, you basically got to hit the ground running or we're canceling the show by Christmas.
Okay.
Because, I mean, this is like 10, 11 years in. SNL is not the institution that it is now. I mean, now it's pretty unthinkable to cancel the thing. But back in 86... it was very thinkable.
Very much. But yeah, but they were able to hit the ground running and come out with some bangers. I believe the first episode with this new cast had Dana Carvey's, I think Dana Carvey did Church Chat in the very first episode.
He did, and he also did Chopping Broccoli, which was one of his bits from his stand-up act. And I remember very distinctly watching that episode. Sigourney Weaver was the host. And yeah, that was like,
Chopping Broccoli.
And I was like, this is my SNL.
Home.
And so, yeah, the cast gels very quickly. And there's buzz about the show again. And like people have favorites. And the, again, these are almost all unknowns at this point.
Yeah, and then it goes into the 90s with Sandler and Farley.
Yeah.
I think Chris Rock had a quote saying like, oh, yeah, you know, you could have called me a diversity hire, but I think history has proven that I'm at least as funny as Rob Schneider.
Killer quote. Man, if you're doing a documentary, get Chris Rock in there. I mean, even if he's not directly involved, Chris Rock will have something cool to say.
I would like a documentary full of Lauren Michael quotes, Chris Rock quotes, and John Mulaney storytelling.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And this documentary is it. I want more documentaries like this. Yeah. And apparently Lauren told Sandler and Rock, he's like, the reason I hired you is you both displayed original thought. Which is that's a really interesting way to put it. Yeah. Cause I think he was like, yeah, these are voices we're not hearing elsewhere. These are colors in the palette that we don't have in the show right now.
Yeah. So, no, that's a good way to see it. Like, I think that's the thing with Lorne. I think he recognizes like original thought, even if it's something he might not get. Like, I think also in the doc, they mentioned how he like really kind of takes younger people's kind of view of the world and their comedy more seriously than maybe somebody older would.
And that makes a lot of sense because it does give sort of a through line to the show, because you've got people, he's hiring people like Sandler and Rock and up to like, say, Bowen Yang and Sarah Sherman or you know, even people like Chloe Trost or Michael Longfellow, who didn't maybe last on the show that long, but they all have original thought.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there was that one scene where they, at the table read, where, you know, they show that Lorne, like they're reading a script, and, like, even though he might not get it, because maybe there's a bunch of young people references in it that he might not get, he sees that it's doing well at the table. So he knows enough to be like, all right, maybe we'll hold on to that then.
Yeah, he's certainly smart and insightful enough to not be like, this show needs to appeal to me and my taste as a 75 to 80 year old man.
Yes.
Because like as somebody says at one point, it was like, if he'd continued on with the original cast, the show would have been long canceled by now.
Yeah.
But the fact that the show evolves and reinvents itself, that's what keeps it fresh.
Yeah, very much so. And it's been doing that for a while. Like, then they also talk about the movies Lorne went to produce. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, of course, the mega hit that was Wayne's World and Coneheads, Tommy Boy, and Mean Girls.
And it was really a really interesting tidbit. They said that Wayne's World and The Three Amigos are the only posters of the movies Lorne's produced that are in his office. Those are the only posters he keeps up.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like, as far as I know, he didn't have anything to do with the Blues Brothers movie. That was not really strictly an SNL production.
No, I don't think
that
so.
That was them spinning the characters off into their own thing with John Landis.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah, I guess if I was Lorne, I would, out of all the SNL movies, those would be the two I would have in my office, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so no Ladies Man and Coneheads posters.
No
Stuart Says His Family. No, it's Pat.
No, God, no. That goes in the incinerator. No. Maybe later.
By the way, like the first summer hiatus we were doing this podcast, we went through all the SNL spinoff movies.
All of them.
And it gets depressing after a while.
Woo!
Like you watch Blues Brothers, you're like, okay, this is pretty good. You watch Wayne's World, you're like, okay. Wayne's World 2, it's okay, a notch below. And then it's like, oh, fuck, what have we done?
Oh, my God. What have we done? Yeah, It's Pad was rough.
I think It's Pat was the one that broke me that summer.
Yeah, that was rough guts.
Yeah, we try to space them out, the good and the bad ones, a little more these days. But yeah. back then we were just going strict chronological order. So we were going from like 1980 up to like the mid 90s or wherever. And that was rough.
We watched the movie, so you don't have to.
We watched it, you know, and then we were like, we still had a few weeks left of the summer, so we were like, let's do Animal House, let's do Delta House, and then we watched Wired, the John Belushi biopic, which is just so freaking bizarre.
That might be worse than It's Pat. Which is worse, It's Pat or Wired?
I find Wired entertaining in a train wreck sort of way. Because it's just so nutty.
Okay.
You know, and they make so many weird choices. And so I found it fascinating in like a train wreck way. And then, but It's Pat just really had hardly any entertainment value.
Yeah, it was pretty empty. It was pretty devoid of anything.
Yeah, you know. Gun to my head, if I had to watch one again, I would probably go with Wired.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. What about you?
It's been a while since I've seen either one of them, and I kind of want to keep it that way. Yeah. But I remember, you know, I think you're right. I remember Wired being bad, but fascinatingly bad.
Yeah. And it has two different framing devices. They have the ghost of John Belushi looking back on his life with a guardian angel who is a Puerto Rican cab driver, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And we also have Bob Woodward investigating Belushi's life and interviewing people that Belushi knew, and it's wild.
All right. It's Pat is coming back to me. Yeah, It's Pat. I remember just being just nothing there.
Yeah,
it was just like this.
And it's a lot of jokes that haven't aged well, because like the central joke of Pat is all, "What gender is he? She?"
Yeah,
it's.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. Rough guts.
Yeah, I don't remember much to recommend that as.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. the doc also talks about the controversial moments of SNL. Of course, the biggest one being the Sinead O'Connor one, where she ripped up the picture of the Pope.
Right.
I did like how they showed how people don't remember that the show kept going after that.
Yeah, and they show briefly the sketch that was right after that, which was Sweet Jimmy, the World's Nicest Pig, which was the sketch after that. Because I guess that was during her second musical segment. Because, after the first musical segment, it's always Weekend Update. So
right,
that had to be like pretty deep into the show. And Tim Robbins was the host.
Yes.
So we have Tim Robbins as a pimp. I'm laughing already.
Tim Robbins as a pimp, you got me.
Yeah, and he's a smiley, nice pimp. Which, funny idea, honestly.
It's pretty good. I would like to see that sketch.
I got to check on YouTube to see if that might be floating around somewhere. I would like to see Sweet Jimmy, the world's nicest pimp.
Oh, he's so sweet.
But they also talk about hit on other controversial moments like Canteen Boy, where it's Alec Baldwin is playing a scoutmaster who is
like molest a young boy.
Yeah, he's coming on to Adam Sandler's Canteen Boy, and very funny but very wrong.
The stunt baby sketch with Buck Henry they do, which I don't remember that one.
I didn't remember that one at all. This doc, it really made me realize like certain gaps in. Like, because I haven't seen every single episode from the first 5 years because I was like in single digits when it was airing.
Right. No, same.
So, and I've watched like the abbreviated hour long versions on Comedy Central or whatever. But there's still things I haven't seen. I don't remember the stunt baby sketch at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny premise where, they're shooting a movie and Buck Henry has to throwing on a baby. So, they get into stunt baby so he could throw a baby out the window.
So they take out one fake baby, they give him another fake baby, and then he's suddenly tossing it all over the room. It's a funny visual, and it's just so wrong. And as they say, like, you get a certain type of laughter when you're doing something that's really out there or taboo, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Which is, it's a type of comedy that's for some people, but not for others, Because 1995, that's when Don Ohlmeyer gets into our lives.
By the way, well, we also see clips of Lorne Michaels being interviewed by Matt Lauer, who, of course, knows all about appropriate and inappropriate.
The irony of that scene.
It really, it's so funny to see. It was like what we now know about Matt Lauer.
Wow, yeah.
That we didn't know back then. But they, and they also make the point that, like, the show was getting a lot of bad reviews in 1995 because there were, like, a lot of baby boomer critics. And part of what they were responding to was, like, this is not our generation's comedy anymore.
Yeah. The people that grew up with SNL are old now and they don't.
Right.
I don't understand. You know,
they're getting into their, like, 30s, early 40s.
Yeah. They're in the suburbs now and they have kids. Yeah. And they're like, yeah. I don't understand this new comedy.
And yeah, and Adam Sandler and Chris Farley and them, they're not doing baby boomer comedy. They're doing, like, Gen X and younger comedy. So
yeah, absolutely. So it's you know, there's a divide.
I mean, honestly, I felt some of that paradigm shift when, like, guys like Sandler and Farley came on, because it was just like, who are these guys? And they're not as funny as, like, Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman. So I even felt that to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think they kind of call that era, like, kind of like the frat bro boy era. Yeah, I definitely kind of felt that too, where it's like, oh, I mean, I get it, but it's definitely kind of a lot of low hanging fruit kind of comedy and not as cerebral as I like.
As they put it, like, you know, Fatty Fall Down or also, like, comedy of the haha, he's gay variety. And that's the joke.
Yeah, you know? Very much so. And but yeah, like, this is the years where Don Ohlmeyer was, like, heading up things, and, you know, he very much didn't like Sandler or Farley, and he was basically wanted Lauren to let them go, and that's when they kind of cut to that polar bear sketch, which I kind of remember, not really, where we were saying goodbye to Sandler and Farley with them jumping into a polar bear pit and getting mauled.
Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten about that sketch because you know, I don't rewatch stuff from that era of the show too much, so I mean, obviously they knew they were on their way out, or they figured they probably were, and yeah, so they're like, kind of, let's go out in a blaze of glory. And they also have, like, sort of an animated thing. This is another sort of TV funhouse segment of Don Ohlmeyer lecturing Lorne, and it's in this boardroom, and it kind of reminded me of those scenes at the end of Network where Ned Beatty's talking to Howard Beale.
Yeah, I'm positive that's what they were going for. They were,
yeah, they were trying to do Network. I was like, this is so Network.
Yeah, they were doing Network for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You have interfered with the cosmic... I can't remember the lines, but yeah.
Guys, if you haven't seen the movie Network, I implore you to go watch. It is so prescient to what we're living in these days.
Yeah, and Ned Beatty just kicks all the ass. And he has, like, a one-scene cameo, but... he just eats that scene alive. My God.
He bodies that shit, son. But yeah, so this is where they let Sandler and Farley go. They let a lot of the writers go.
Don Ohlmeyer even boasts that he cut the popcorn budget.
That's the last straw.
That's how much he's leaning on Lorne at this point.
So that's why he can't clean it. He's got a budget cut. That's why the popcorn machine's all
grody.
Yeah, that's why the popcorn machine's all grody.
He's afraid a network exec's going to go, what? We're paying him enough to clean his popcorn machine? What the hell?
Too good for grody popcorn.
But so this seems like to be really the first era where Lorne doesn't have total control of the show. He's being overruled by a network person.
Yeah. They went over his head, and it's. Yeah. It's a bummer. And of course, they mention Farley's funeral, how Lorne was there. Yeah. You know, Lorne was crying, which made everybody else cry.
Yeah. And then that evening, he has to meet with Don Ohlmeyer, who's like, yeah, you've got to fire Norm Macdonald.
Jesus.
Because he's making all these jokes about O.J. Simpson.
He's making fun of my murderer friend. And I don't like it.
He's a really nice murderer friend. I mean, you haven't gone golfing with the guy, so.
He tips 20% at Spago's. I mean, come on. Dude's a prince.
Oh, the 90s were so bizarre, man.
So bizarre. How bizarre, how bizarre. Every time. But yeah, so this is where after all this horribleness happens, Lauren has to sort of rebuild the show again. This is where we get the Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry coming in. And
and writers like Paul Pell. And then like, and then over the next few years, like people like Tracy Morgan and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. And it's really like the start of another golden era for the show.
Yeah. There's been a number of people like younger than me who are SNL nerds who really think that the Sandberg, Sudeikis, Wig, Hader era, for them, that's their era. For them, that's like the best the show has ever
been. And I totally get that. That's a great era for the show. I mean, if that's your favorite of the show, I'm not going to argue with you, you know?
Strong era.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think every generation deserves its own era of SNL. So
Here. Mm-hmm. But then Olmeyer leaves, of course. And I think this is where Conan has that quote. So he's like really such, like Lorne is just sort of a stalwart of show business. Like so many other execs have come and gone, but he's still here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. And this is, I thought this was interesting too, where Lorne and Steve Martin are having dinner, then Steve asks him if he's going to retire. Mm-hmm. And then Lorne says, no, I don't think I am, because like, you know, the show is kind of from another time and I'm sort of the protector of it from the network. And which is something I've thought, and I think I've even said on this podcast where, I feel like Lorne kind of has to be there because if he leaves, then the network is kind of going to fuck with the show and just cut the budget.
Yeah, I don't feel like there's anybody else who has the skill set to do it all. You know, I mean, obviously the show would change or evolve if it's no longer Lorne producing it, but really even just the structure of the show is from another era. Cause it's like the variety show that was big in the 70s, and you have this mixture of comedy and music and occasionally, other novelty acts, like you have magicians like Penn and Teller come on, or Bill Hodgson doing prop comedy.
Yeah, Harry Anderson came on and did magic.
Harry Anderson in the 80s. I mean, it's, you don't see that type of stuff as much on the show anymore, but if you really think about the show, like you have like the musical guest, Weekend Update, fake commercials, and there's no other show like it on TV because it was conceived in like the mid 70s when variety shows were a big thing.
Yeah, and I think because we live in this era now where like late night is kind of really taking a hit, and everything in late night is kind of getting dismantled. And I think
What have you heard?
Let's talk off air about that.
Okay.
But I think Lauren has a point. He's like, I feel like if I left, the show would just like chop down the show's budget to just ribbons.
Yeah.
And like I don't know, like I feel like
SNL be an hour? Couldn't we pre-tape more stuff?
Can't we cut this cast down to two people?
What if it's like a sitcom about two sketch performers who fall in love in New York City? Does it have to air at 11:30?
Does it have to air on Saturdays?
Yeah.
At night.
Does it have to be live?
Can we do pre-tape Thursday mornings?
Yes.
I think he makes a point because I know we said like, oh, maybe Tina Fey should take over, or you know, Steve Higgins or whoever. But yeah, like I feel like if anybody else did take over, the network would like swoop in and fuck with it.
But, yeah, because I mean, I don't know if anybody else is as bulletproof as Lorne is at this point, because he has outlasted everybody.
Yeah, he really has.
I mean, he really has made his own unique position at the network and in life, it's weird to think. And then they get into, he's got like this vacation home in Maine. He's got a blueberry farm.
What?
I don't remember them getting into this in the Lorne Michaels book, or maybe I've just forgotten it because it's been a few months, but.
Yeah. But like, they talk about, I think Martin Short is like, he gives out blueberry preserves to all of us.
Somebody said, I didn't write down who said this, but they said, it's possible he hunts people at the blueberry farm.
Oh, that was Conan. Conan.
Okay, that seems like such a Conan line.
Yeah, he was like, oh, I'd be afraid if I went up there, he would like hunt me and be like, Conan, man is the greatest game.
Yes. Suddenly we're in the most dangerous game.
I'll give you a 45-minute head start.
Yeah.
He like runs through the field. He finds the skeleton of Dennis Miller lying somewhere.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, it's somebody you didn't even realize was dead, but it's like, it's, you know, there's Dennis Miller's corpse. So funny.
Conan, babe, he's crazy with that gun there, babe.
I'm decomposing faster than obscure reference.
Cha-cha. Yeah, okay.
Let's see what else we got. We're skipping around. They get into his childhood a little bit here.
A little bit.
Then they talk about how, you know, his father had a heart attack in 1959 when Lauren was age 14. I do remember reading about this era.
Yeah, his dad Lefty Lipowitz.
Yeah.
What a 40s nickname that is.
And he died, like, I think just after Lauren had a fight with him.
Yeah, he had a fight with his dad at like 14 or something. Mm-hmm. Father left and he had a heart attack while on the road. And mm-hmm. also they mentioned his Lauren's brother, Mark. Lauren has a brother? I never knew this until this podcast.
Yeah.
This
episode. Yeah.
That was, I had no idea. Is he still alive? I had no idea.
Wild. I don't know.
Wild.
I don't know. Might be one of the people that Lauren hunted on his blueberry farm.
Who knows? Mark, I'll give you a 45-minute start.
Because your family.
I knew it was you, Mark. You broke my heart.
You broke my heart.
Oh, God.
Now go out fishing. Godfather 2, guys. Basically, that's our big takeaway from this episode of the podcast is, like, watch lots of great movies in the 70s. Watch Network. Watch the Godfather movies.
Yeah, watch them all.
Yeah, watch them all. Chinatown, that's one of my faves.
Ooh. I remember watching Chinatown years ago and, like, being kind of bummed out by the ending, but I guess that was the point. Whereas, like...
Yeah. I'm fair to say you're expected to be a little bummed out.
Yeah, life's a bummer.
If you're at the end of Chinatown and you're just like, yeah, rah, rah, that's an ending.
I think because before then I was always kind of used to, like, you know, the law gets his man and everything turns out all right. And then I saw that. I was like, oh, actually, no. Sometimes the bad guys get away and you can't do shit about it. Well,
yeah.
A spoiler, I guess, for Chinatown.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, folks, you've had like over 50 years to catch Chinatown. So.
I was just about to watch Chinatown. It's on my queue.
Chinatown is great. It's one of my favorite movies.
It's fantastic.
I guess I should just mention for the record, Roman Polanski, horrible person, obviously, but
yes, but, of course.
God, Chinatown is a masterpiece.
Yeah, but they do get into Lauren's background a little bit, talking about putting on shows at sleepaway camp and then Lauren did have this great quote when he was up there in Maine talking about how the older you get, the more you think about your childhood, you see some things more clearer, and then. Yeah. The older you get, you realize that it's on its way. And then the interviewer is like, what's on its way? And he says, change is right around the corner at all times, which is, it's pretty profound, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. That's, I mean, you think he's going to say death, but you know, he just says change. Because death is like one of the biggest changes of all.
Oof. The Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like what they say in the MASH theme song. You know, suicide is painless, brings on many changes. But I can take or leave it if I please.
This is getting really deep, dark. Wow, this is taking a grim turn.
MASH movie, 1970.
We just recommended all these movies from the 70s now.
We did. I watched so many movies from the 70s when I was in college, man. I still like that decade a lot for movies. Yeah.
That was probably one of the best decades for cinema, I'd say.
I had, okay, there quick diversion, then we'll get back to Lauren. I had, there was a girlfriend I was dating in like late 90s, from like 98 to 2000. And she reached out to me on Facebook one day and she was like, I finally saw the movie MASH. Yeah. And she was like, and she like didn't get why I liked it, because she was like, it was so mean and misogynistic and you're not. So like, well, why do you like this movie? And I couldn't really argue with her because I was like, well, yeah, it is.
It was a different time.
I don't know. I didn't know what to tell her, but she was just kind of like, I don't get this. This is so And I was, and the, I didn't even remember like talking the movie up to her, but I guess I did at some point and it stuck in her head.
Oh boy.
If you've never seen the movie version of MASH, the original version of movie of MASH, it's very different from the TV show. And the show seems very, very sanitized after you watch it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the movie version of MASH. But yeah, I remember being like, oh, this ain't the TV version.
Yeah.
This ain't your daddy's MASH.
Like, you find out how Margaret Houlihan gets the nickname Hot Lips.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. I chew on it. So Lorne.
Anyway, Tina Fey says Lorne might be the last guy in show business.
Yeah, which, and
again, another killer quote.
Good quote. I mean, and she also admits that, you know, the character of Jack Donaghy, Alec Baldwin's character from 30 mm-hmm. Rock, yeah, is based a lot on Lorne. And
what?
Yeah. Look, hey, hold on to your horse. Hold on to your socks. I don't want to.
Yeah, they show that famous clip of Alec Baldwin. You know, she says, like, why are you in a tux? And he's like, it's after six. What am I, a farmer? But they're showing Lorne while he's saying that line. And Lorne in the tux, which, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's putting on the Ritz. I get it.
Yeah. Because, you know, I'm sure there have been days where, like, Lorne, he's like, okay, I've got to leave rehearsal early. I've got to go to the opera. I've got to go to this premiere.
Of course.
Yeah.
The Tonys are
I've got to go kill James Bond.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I would see a James Bond movie with a Lorne Michaels type villain, wouldn't you?
I would.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that what Dr. Evil is, kind of?
Kind of. I guess so. Yeah, they there have a segment in the movie where it's like lots of cast members imitating Lorne.
Everybody's having a Lorne off.
Yeah. I mean, who do you think does the best Lorne? I'd say probably Carvey, right?
Yeah. He's good. I like
Bill Hader's is really good.
I was just about to say Bill Hader. Bill Hader's a close second. But
those are the two contenders, I think.
Yeah, everybody else is decent, but yeah, Carvey and Hader are.
It's like one of those things where it's like there's one person who sort of unlocks the key of how to do a particular person. They find like the Rosetta Stone of this is how you imitate this person. Like, you know, the way Dana Carvey did the Nakadette for the first George Bush.
Yeah,
and then everybody was just doing an impression of Dana Carvey's impression.
Yeah, because I feel like Dana Carvey was the first one to do it. Then everybody just, it's kind of, like you said, doing it Dana's way.
Yeah. So I feel like it's everybody to some degree is doing a Dana Carvey Lorne Michaels.
Right.
Yeah.
So now it's Saturday and we're doing dress rehearsals. We see Lorne watching him from under the bleachers, him being quite savage about some of the sketches that aren't going over super well.
And I hear like him having like this little sort of chamber under the bleachers. It's like a Lorne cave, man.
Yeah.
I always imagined it as something like you can kind of see out, but no, he's not like watching the stage. He's watching a monitor. So he's kind of getting an impression of what it looks like as a show.
Yeah, and he's also kind of commenting on how, like, oh, the audience is kind of dead. These sketches aren't going over well. Like,
right.
I think Paul Appel said that being under the bleachers with Lorne is like, the bleachers are like sponsored by Imodium because everyone just runs and shits themselves when he doesn't like a sketch.
Right, because he's so intimidating. And yeah, and they talk about like his little tics, like when a sketch isn't working or when it's not what Lorne thought it would be, he's just sort of like, exhales like,
which is why I saw him do when I saw him do that exhale. He does it during because like I saw on the monitor he was watching the Mama Cass sketch from the Emma Stone episode.
Oh, make your own kind of music.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that got a heavy sound.
What the hell, Lorne?
That shit was magic. What are you talking about, Mr. Michaels?
I guess he's comparing it with the version he imagined in his head, but God damn it. What the hell?
What the?
Hashtag justice for Chloe Trost.
Make your own kind of music. Yeah, but like...
Every time that comes up, it's been like, two years? And I'm still...
Just fuming.
Mad about that.
It's like that old Abbott and Costello. It was like the guy says like Niagara Falls and he just goes off on Costello.
Yeah, slowly I turn. Inch by inch. Yeah.
Step by step, inch by inch.
Cleaning woman!
Nice.
Edmund, don't wear plaid. That's a movie from the 80s. There you go. See, we're moving forward in time.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yes, it uses a clip from 1940s movies. I don't care. It's still an 80s movie.
Hey, still works, man. Still works. Yeah. I did like how Joe told him, was like, yeah, sometimes he can be kind of really biting. Like when he's under the bleachers at one point, like they were watching a sketch Joe wrote that wasn't going over well. And he told Joe, he told Joe, hey, can they take the Emmy back?
Yeah. I think, and at one point, like, Jay is like, oh, well, the writer. And he's like, oh, this sketch had writers. I'm just like,
Damn, and Lauren. Shit.
I have a note here. I don't think I wrote down the context of it. It says, Jay calls it White Motown. Was he just talking about SNL in general?
Oh, fuck. I didn't write that down. He does say that. Yeah. I think he was talking about SNL, I believe.
Yeah.
And then Joe's is like, hey, does Motown not have white people?
Yeah.
And Jay's like, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's nice dry Joe's humor there. Joe's just, he really has grown on me as a writer and a performer.
For sure.
I will say.
Yeah.
I used to hate the guy. This was like way back before we started the podcast, but.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like, I see the appeal.
Yeah. Of course, it'd go into Lauren's hatred of breaking. Talk about the Beavis and Butthead sketch, the now infamous. Right. But then they show clips of Lorne breaking in his Hart and Lorne sketches from back in the 60s. So what the fuck, sir?
Well, you know, again, it's like Chris Rock says, you don't have to be a great player to be a great coach. So
that's true. I did
you're going to be the harshest on the things you hate in yourself, I think.
Yeah. I did like how, because of that, Bruce McCulloch called him a hack.
Yeah.
You hack.
I love that. Yeah. And we also hear like little interesting tidbits like the papyrus sketch.
Yes.
Apparently that was way over time. And like the first cut was like literally 8 minutes long and they didn't think they could get that down to time. And that's like probably the Ryan Gosling sketch, that or the alien abduction sketches. But
yeah. Cause I think they're talking about the one that they weren't able to get it on the air. But then they put up something towards the end of the show and be like, oh, the papyrus sketch is up on YouTube now. Go watch it. And I was like, I'd never seen them do that before. Like,
I'd forgotten that wasn't part of the aired show.
Yeah, yeah. It was
because they did a follow-up on it, kind of like what they did with the cast list sketch, because that was a cut-for-time sketch, and they did a sequel to it because it was so popular online.
Yeah, but it wasn't the last time Ryan hosted. It was the time before that. But, yeah, like, it was – he did the show, and, like, I guess everybody was expecting the papyrus sketch, but it never showed up. And then they showed, like, a title card saying, hey, go see the papyrus sketch sequel on YouTube.
That's right.
And I was like, what the fuck? I've never seen this before.
It's so – you know, like the cut for time sketches and the aired sketches, they all kind of muddle together in my head now. Mm. I don't really divvy up different headspace for those on the show because, like, so many of them, you just end up watching on YouTube anyway. So there isn't much of a barrier between those two.
Yeah, understood. That's true. Mm. But yeah. So then they, after the dress rehearsal, Lauren and the producers need to trim about 30 minutes to decide on the final order.
Right.
Choose the order, you know, talk.
And this is a scene where it's like in Lauren's office and he's in with the host and people like Steve Higgins and other producers. And they kind of cut among different hosts. You know, I think you see like Jonah Hill in there at one point. You see Shane Gillis. You see, I think, and it's a little disorienting because it's like, oh, weird. Okay. But it somehow works.
Yeah, for sure. It does work. I will say that. Absolutely. And but then Lauren talks to the cast, talking about, the dress rehearsal was pretty rough. But, you know, he said the audience was sleeping on pavement at some point.
I think he means like they were talking about, you know, they were waiting to get in.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, like people camp out.
That makes sense.
Get in for tickets. So okay. Yeah, so he was probably talking about that.
That makes sense.
I think he meant literally sleeping on pavement.
Okay. That makes sense. But then he's able to rally around the cast and crew, say, hey, we're gonna put on a great show and and that's when people like really kinda talk up Lauren, talking about how he's like really kinda they look to him for guidance and advice. And Conan talks about how, yeah, his only legitimacy when he got the late night show for after Letterman was like Lorne kind of chose him, saying like, oh yeah, this guy should be the late. Yeah, because I do remember those times when Conan got the show after Letterman. Like no one, everybody was like, who is this guy?
Yeah, like I remember at his initial press conference, a reporter referred to him as a relative unknown, and Conan quickly said, sir, I am a complete unknown.
Like a Rolling Stone.
Because he'd written for SNL and he'd written for The Simpsons. So he certainly had a pedigree in the comedy world and among comedy writers in particular. But the general public, no idea who Conan was.
Yeah.
And then this 29-year-old kid is going to replace Letterman. It's such a wild choice.
It was.
They were talking about people like Dana Carvey or... Were they talking about Jon Stewart at that point? I think they were, yeah.
Maybe. He would have been in the conversation for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm sure Chevy Chase wasn't brought up.
No.
He's had his time. I did like how Mulaney talked about how Lorne called him when he was in rehab. And he said, yeah, I'll stay on the phone with you as long as you want. We can talk about whatever. We don't have to talk about
What's
going on. We can talk about whatever. Like, there's a lot of things. A lot of times, like, Lorne really does reach out to the people.
And then he's like, so Lorne and I talked about, like, this stupid mistake that Peacock had made in their rollout.
Oh, yeah, for not having on Samsung TVs.
Right. And Mulaney also said, Lorne is protecting you in ways you have no idea about.
Wow.
And I think that's another thing that makes Lorne Michaels unique is he is fighting these battles so his cast doesn't have to, you know?
Mm. It's really important. I mean, even Conan says, like, yeah, one of Lorne's superpowers is that we all want to make him happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then they go up and show Lorne at his farm in Maine, sort of comparing his cast members and to, like, daffodils. You know, keeping them alive, keeping them going if you still think it's relevant.
Yeah.
There's kind of a nice, sweet little moment here.
And I loved at the end, like, we see moments that we've never seen in other SNL docs. We see them, like, wheeling out the board with all the final rundown of sketches. And we see Lorne's pep talk in between dress and air. And, you know, he's just like, oh, well, you know, the audience for dress wasn't good, but, you know, we're going to give him a great show. And it's just seeing a Lorne Michaels pep talk. That was amazing.
Yeah. I've
so many moments I feel like we've never seen on film before. That was great to see.
Yeah. Like, I will say this about I do like the doc, but I will say, like, you don't learn that much more about him, but you do.
Yeah.
But the parts you do get to see, I greatly appreciate. Like that, like the part where you see him giving a pep talk or like little moments here and there.
They make the show early on that, you know, the show is Lorne and Lorne is the show.
Right.
So, like, we learned a little more about the show. So I feel like, therefore, we learned a little more about Lorne.
Yes.
By the transitive property of Lorneism.
Right, because I think you're right. I think we've got to mention that. Like, they do say early in this doc, like, to understand Lorne is to understand the show. So,
right.
Because they focused on the show quite a bit in this doc. But like you said, by transitive properties, you learn more about Lorne.
But I think you learn a lot. I mean, particularly if you haven't read Susan Morrison's book, Lorne, the Man Who Created Saturday Night Live. I think I'm getting that right.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot to get out of this.
Yeah, for sure. I highly recommend this doc. Like,
yeah.
I mean, if you're an SNL nerd, I think you'll enjoy it.
A comedy nerd in general.
Yeah, if you're a comedy nerd in general, I think it's definitely worth your time, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It really exceeded my expectations. I was really happy with this. I was, yeah, 5 stars all the way.
This was a good one. But, well, what did the listeners think? We put out the word on Blue Sky and our Facebook page too, and we got something on Facebook here.
Oh, okay. Well, I got the Blue Sky comments up here, so I can read one of those, and then you can go into Facebook.
Let's do it.
Okay. So first we got Manette Moratti, who says, "It was when I wanted to know every single name of Lorne's goats that I realized I needed to get a life."
Oh, Manette.
I get that. I get that impulse. He has some animals on the blueberry farm. I think he says, like, yeah, I wanted animals to raise that I would never have to eat.
That's sweet.
So we learned that Lauren doesn't eat goats.
Yeah. That's some new knowledge for us.
Yeah, I don't think they went into the names of the goats, but yes, I would be curious as to what the names of the goats are.
Maybe he named them after who he thinks the greatest cast members of all time were.
Yeah.
The goats.
Yeah. It's like that old story about Gilda Radner. She said, I would look through Lauren's desk, and I was always hoping to find a note that said, Gilda is my favorite. I love that story.
That's so sweet.
It really is. That just sums up Gilda Radner so well.
So on our Facebook, we heard from Jeff Knapp.
My friend Jeff Knapp. Jeff.
Your friend Jeff Knapp saying, for a documentary focusing on Lauren, it was an excellent SNL documentary. It's as if he has no other facets. Vague covering of his non-SNL years. I was hoping for more.
Mm. Well, yeah, Jeff. Maybe if you want more, you might want to check out Susan Morrison's book. It's very comprehensive, and it does go into a lot of the lost years of Lorne Michaels. This doc is, what, I think it's like an hour 45, something like that?
Yeah, around that.
Yeah, it's a lot of ground to cover, so.
Yeah, but it's good. It's definitely good.
Yeah. And let's see, over back on Blue Sky, we've got Nick Storr, who says, it was fairly good. I got annoyed by the memification at points. I'm not quite sure what they mean, what Nick means by memification, but.
I'm not 100% sure.
I like that he got mad by throwing ice.
Yes. That's the other thing he does. He throws ice in the cooler. Not like at people.
Yes, they make that very clear. He's not like throwing ice in anger at people, but if he's annoyed, he'll like throw ice into a cooler. And Nick also says, also, I wondered which sketch Andrew was overacting in. I don't remember Lauren saying that.
I don't think so.
I think that must have gone right over my head. Nick, you noticed lots of things that I didn't notice. I remember the throwing ice, but I don't know what you mean by the memification at points. And then which sketch Andrew Dismukes was overacting in. I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. That's our episode, guys. Lauren Michaels, Lauren, the doc, available on Peacock. Worth your time.
Yeah. I mean, if you're on Peacock to check out SNL anyway, give this a watch. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I was very pleasantly surprised. I was expecting it to be good, but it was really better than I expected. So
Best doc out of all the SNL Peacock docs we've seen?
Like going against those four we got last year for the 50th?
Yeah, that, and I'll include the music, SNL music.
Oh, geez. Well. You know, the Questlove doc was pretty great. The concert was pretty great. The four specials were kind of a mixed bag. It's tough to say. I mean, it's certainly better than like that Saturday Night doc that James Franco Sexpest made.
Oh yeah, we did an episode about that too.
We did. You remember that?
I do.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
So I mean, I enjoyed that at the time. It had moments I liked. But, I mean, this obviously blows out of the water because it's a professional documentary filmmaker.
Absolutely. And that's some sex pest with a camcorder.
I mean, he was doing it for class and, you know, he's taking advantage of his celebrity to get access no other NYU student could. But
Yeah, good for – must be nice.
And maybe he's like, hey, maybe there'll be some more women I can harass up there.
One can hope.
Don't you love how, like, when we as a society kind of decided we were done with James Franco, we were just like, let's just slide Dave Franco into his place. He's like the better Franco.
It was wild. Yeah, we all just did that pivot. Be like,
it was like rotating players in volleyball or something. It was just like all of a sudden, yeah, okay, Dave Franco. Let's have Dave Franco.
The more stable Franco.
The stable Franco. He's cool. He's married to Alison Brie.
Yeah.
He's in those Now You See Him movies.
Yeah, he does. He's cool. He was in Superbad for a minute.
He was in Superbad. That was his first movie.
Yeah.
He's in the 21 Jump Street movies.
Does all right. Yeah, he's cool.
We haven't done the 21 Jump Street movies, have we?
No. We did one.
Did we? Okay. We got to do 22 Jump Street then.
Okay, done.
Yeah. You know, it's got Rob Riggle, it's got Bill Hader.
All right, done and done. Let's do it.
Some other people, yes.
And the rest.
We did 21 Jump Street, really. Okay, I'm going to go back and listen to that one.
I'm fairly certain. I remember us doing it. But yeah, it's okay. Probably one of those summer movies we did. I'm fairly certain. Yeah.
Let me see if I can find the episode number. I'm curious now.
Okay, go for it. But I will put.
I'm a Googling. It was episode 304, less than 100 episodes ago.
There you go. Told ya.
We're going back like less than 90 episodes, and I've already forgotten it. We did this in 2024.
Really shows that your heart is in this podcast, John.
Look, you know, hey, you tell me more about this podcast. I will start listening to it. This seems like a show I would listen to and enjoy.
I think you might be like it. I think you might be into it.
What I need to do is just like wait 2 years and then listen to the episodes, and then I'm coming to them fresh.
It's new to me.
Like a few times I have done that. I've like listened to old episodes just for, I don't know, shits and giggles. And the nice thing is that like while I'm listening, I'm like, oh, you should bring this up. And then like, you or I bring it up.
Yeah, we read your mind.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the experience I have, but because, you know, me from 2 years ago thinks a lot like me today, but.
There it is.
And, all right, well, episode 304, I'm going to have to listen to that.
Yeah, give it a listen, see what you think.
Yeah.
And that's the episode, guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast, as always. You can follow us on the Blue Skies at SNL Nerds. You can listen to this on our YouTube page, non-productive.com, you can listen to. You can donate to our Patreon. And as always, you can follow me, myself, and I on all the socials at Darren Credible, D-A-R-I-N, Credible.
And you can follow me on all the socials at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L and the word comic. And check us out on the YouTube. Check us out on the Patreon. You can see all of our... You can listen to all of our old episodes on YouTube or at non-productive.com. And rate and review us on the podcaster of your choice. That really helps us out, and that helps boost us in the algorithm and all that good stuff.
Help us keep this little boat afloat.
Mm-hmm. And if you have any suggestions for what movies you would like us to cover starring an SNL alum, let us know on Blue Sky at SNL Nerds. And, we will do our best to get to it.
Yes, as long as it's not too terrible a movie.
Well, as long as it's not too terrible and as long as it's not a thing that we've already done.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, we're probably not going to, like, watch Wired again.
No, I'm saying that right now. We're not going to watch Wired again. We're not watching It's Pat again.
Yeah.
Put my foot down on that.
I'm not watching Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar again.
No, we're not going down that road again. No.
We're not going down that road.
No. We won't watch, Spring Breakdown? I remember we did.
I remember very little about Spring Breakdown, except we didn't like it.
It was good. Yeah, it's pretty whack.
You know what I would like to do sometime, what I might get a kick out of, is I missed when you did Dragnet. I missed that week, and I wouldn't mind going back and doing Dragnet sometime.
Oh, Dragnet Redux?
Yeah, because you did that with Evan, didn't you?
My buddy Evan Morgenstern, yes, my old comedy partner.
Who you've also hosted the podcast with.
Yes. So, maybe we'll do it. I wouldn't mind doing Dragnet again. It's one of my favorite movies growing up.
Yeah, because I remember that week I was just like, oh, they did Dragnet. I wanted to do Dragnet.
Sorry.
No, but it's okay. It is what it is, you know, but.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll do Dragnet again.
We'll do Dragnet sometime. Yeah. Or maybe I'll get somebody else and I'll do my own Dragnet episode. I'll go rogue.
I'll do my own Dragnet.
I'll do a Dragnet without you.
I'll show you.
I'll show you.
That'll learn you.
But okay, so let's see. I don't think we can officially announce what we're doing next week quite yet, but we got something cool in the works.
We do. We can't. Yeah. We have some ideas, but nothing final. We'll let you know when everything's been finalized.
We'll let you know. Keep an eye on the Facebook page at SNL Nerds. Keep an eye on the Blue Sky account at SNL Nerds. And we'll keep you posted. We'll let you know.
Yeah.
But stay tuned. Stay tuned, True Believers. Same bat time, same bat channel. And we'll join you for a new episode next week, whatever it might be. But until then, Nerds Out!
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.